Welcome to another episode of the Made Musings podcast, the podcast where we try to raise awareness about different disabilities and societal issues and the way they affect mental health. We tell real life stories of people who are actually involved in these disabilities and living with these different societal issues. So on today's episode, I am joined by Sarah Dorset, all the way from Maine, and she's going to be sharing a story of being in an abusive relationship, how she got out and how those things affected her and all that. So welcome, Sarah.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for having me. I love when people give a voice and an opportunity for people to speak about this stuff, so thanks for hosting.
Oh, brilliant. So can you give us a bit of background information about yourself generally? I know you are an author and an advocate for people living with domestic abuse. So what more do you do?
So first and foremost, I'm a wife and a mom. My daughter just turned 2 months ago. That's a fun learning experience. We're like very into toddlerhood right now. And other than that, I am a consultant in the defense industry in the United States. So that's kind of my day job. And then on the side, I do some advocacy work, helping other survivors of domestic violence.
Yeah.
I authored my book, as you stated, and that has kind of helped build a platform for me to get started and start talking with people. A large part of my story involved financial and economic abuse, and there's more people out there talking about, you know, physical violence. I mean, that's the stuff you see in the movies and stuff, but one of the things that we don't talk about enough is some of the answers to those questions that people ask, which is, why do you stay? Why didn't you leave sooner? And what people don't realize is finances is a massive way that people control their partners. And that was definitely the case for me and many other women that I talked to. So in most of my advocacy work, I work with organizations that help women learn about finance, learn about the economics of their finance, right? Like negotiating salary, finance 101 thing with survivors, because a lot of them have been cut off from their finances and they may not know how to balance their checkbook or pay their bills or make a budget. So we do a lot of work with people within that community. I've been lucky enough to recently get an introduction to an organization that helps victims of human trafficking, and I'm going to try to offer the same services for them, you know, talk about getting out of financial control and rebuilding your relationship with money and finances.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. You've talked about different things that you do. You seem to have a lot of things going on at the same time. One thing that struck me is the advocacy work for people who are being trafficked as well. It's something that we don't realize that is still happening in this day and age. But we are going to be talking about your own story and how you got involved with this person. How did you even meet?
So we actually met when I was a sophomore in college. I went out of state for college and he didn't go to my school, but he was, as they call him, the townies, right? Like he lived in the town where my university was located, and he was friends with some of the people that went to my school. And so just through friends, I happened to meet him. The thing about my ex-husband is he was this larger-than-life personality. People were drawn to him like a moth to the flame, right? Like he had just tons and tons of friends. Now, if you got really inside his circle, you would realize that he didn't really have close friends, but he had just a ton of acquaintances. He had so many friends. He was the guy who would go to the bar and buy a round of shots for everybody, right? Like he just wanted to be the life of the party. When I met him, I was raised in a small town by very religious parents. I hadn't really experienced a whole lot, and I was very shy and introverted. And so someone like him kind of bringing me along for the ride was very, very enticing. You know, I had a big circle of friends for really the first time in my life. We were having a blast. That's how we met and kind of how I got kind of pulled into his orbit.
Yeah, it seems natural for a shy girl that was born by religious parents to be drawn to somebody who's like larger than life, the life and soul of the party, who's exuberant and is like outgoing. So it's like everything you don't have, he's got it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, did you get married to him? I mean, at the time. Yeah. And how did the relationship go from normal relationship? What was he ever normal, or was he always controlling us?
When we dated, I felt like it was pretty normal. I didn't have much experience. I wasn't allowed to date when living at home. So I really went into this with no idea what dating or relationships looked like. So for me, it felt pretty normal. We dated for a year and then got engaged, got married 6 months later. I was pretty young, so I was 20 years old when we got married, and he was 2 years older than me, so he was about 22. In my book, I phrase it that the honeymoon was over before it even started.
Oh.
So the darker portions of his personality came out like in the airport on the way to our honeymoon destination. I talk about this one story in the book where he felt like because we were on our honeymoon, we deserved all these free upgrades. And he made such an of himself trying to get these free upgrades, and it was embarrassing. And I remember kind of the first time that I felt like, okay, I need to say something and kind of rein him in because he's getting a little bit belligerent. We had a really early morning flight. We'd been up late the night before for the reception. So I just blamed it on like, he's just cranky and tired. But when I went up to him and I said, it's okay. I don't need a first class upgrade. Like, I'm fine. Let's just go sit down. I remember him grabbing me by the arms and pulling me aside and basically getting in my face and saying, don't you ever correct me in front of people again.
Oh, wow.
And I was just like,
So was it both physically and financially abusive then?
yes. And I mean, he was the master of like these psychological games too. That was one of the hardest parts to deal with because I never knew who was coming home at night. So when we met, I was in college. I dropped out for a little while to follow him for his career. Eventually, we moved back to where we had met, which was the state of Florida. And I got back into school. So I was working full time and I was a full time student in the evenings. I did my bachelor's and my master's that way. And so I would get home from work on the days that I didn't have class before him. And I remember just sitting there doing my homework and just being like anxious and nervous because I was like, I don't know which version of him is going to walk through the door, right? Is it the fun-loving guy I met before, or is it going to be the angry in your face
Frankie.
guy? Yeah. And he just loved to torment me psychologically, right? Like he would play these games where he would say, like, I'm hungry. And I'd be like, okay, well, I made dinner. It's on the table. I don't want anything from you. Oh, okay.
Oh,
So,
wow.
yeah, I'd be like, okay. And so then he'd go to the other room. He'd come back out a little while later. And at this point, I've cleaned up dinner and put it away. And he'd come out. And once again, he'd be like, I'm hungry. And I'm like, okay. So I would drop the paper I'm working on and get up and try to strategize a meal for him. You know, I've got the leftovers. I can make you something else. And it would be the same answer once again. I don't want anything from you.
So what then, why is he telling you he's hungry? Then get
Exactly.
something to eat yourself.
Right. And so, you know, it would be this back and forth all night and to the point where he would like have me in tears and I just be like, I don't know what you want. You can grab something yourself. I'm offering to make you something. Like, yeah, it would go on for hours that he would do this kind of stuff. And it was little games like that that
It
he liked
was
to
like
play.
emotional blackmail, controlling in that way, you know.
Yeah, and I just like, I'm very, especially back then, I'm very non-confrontational. So I just wanted peace in the house. So I was willing to do whatever he needed me to do to like make sure that he was not hungry, that he was happy with the meal that he had. You know, I had this like very traditional upbringing and I was like, okay, well, mom always made dinner. So like, I'm gonna be the dinner person. And he kind of picked up on that and would use that to just kind of pick on me. I don't know. It was very childish. Like looking back at it, I'm like, the games were just so silly and childish. But as long as he was talking, I knew what to expect. When he went quiet is when I wasn't sure what was going to come. You know, it could be a couple of days of the silent treatment and then he would blow up, or it could be a couple hours of the silent treatment and then all of a sudden he's fine. Everything was perfect. I didn't have to worry about it. So it was that type of stuff where he just, ne I my equilibrium was off the whole time. I didn't know which end was up some days.
Yeah, sounds like you were thrown at the deep end of things right from the very start of the marriage. I know relationships are not always smooth sailing, especially when you're first ma newly married. You are two people who have just gone through the dating aspect of relationship and then going into the committed relationship, getting married and moving in together. So it will take you time to get used to each other. But I mean, this sounds like emotional blackmail and just him being a child. And yeah,
I did say that a lot, that he was like, he needed a reparenting.
How long did that go on for?
We were married for a total of 6 years. And I think one of the most important statistics that people need to know about domestic violence, and the numbers that I pull are US based. So obviously it's different depending on what country you're in. But in the United States, it takes an average of 7 attempts to get out and stay out of a domestic violence relationship, which means that there's people who leave the first time and don't go back, but there's people that are there and they try to leave 10, 11, 12 times and they go back for whatever the reasons are. So, and during our relationship, I left him within the first year. I went back to my parents' house. First few days, he was just vile and texting me all these like horrible things. And then eventually he calmed down and we talked like, okay, well, let's work this out. Let's go to therapy, whatever. And so I agreed to go back. Within a year of that incident, I left again. And this time he drove 3 hours to my parents' house where I was, talked with me, talked with my parents. Like we had this whole conversation and he was a salesman. He could sell you anything. Like very, very good with his words and manipulative. And so I got back on board and I was like, we can make this work.
It's good that you had your parents' place to go to, because there are people who have nowhere to run to. And sometimes it's difficult for the relatives or even friends and family to believe that the person they are seeing is actually going through what you're telling them that you're going through. They don't believe you. They don't actually have faith in you. They say, well, it's marriage. You got to stick with it. But it's good that you actually had the ability to take your things and leave, even though he kept coming back to you to convince you to come back to him.
I will say for anybody out there who may have a person that they love in their life that's going through something like this is, so my parents were really there for me when I left the first 2 times. After that, we ended up moving back to Florida from Maine and being that far away from them. And we were lived back there for the last 4 years of our marriage. When I finally reached out to my parents 4 years later, and I was like, I think I'm leaving him. Like, this is it. The response was, well, it's the holidays. And things are really stressful around the holidays. So I think like just stick it out through the holidays. And once things calm down, you guys can probably work it out and all this stuff. And so at that point, I was on the other side of the country. I didn't have a place to go. And so I kind of had to make the decisions on my own. And I was like, there were things going on that they didn't know about, right? Because a lot of us, when we're in it, we don't share everything, either out of fear, shame. We don't want people to look at us differently. Whatever the reasons are, they're valid. They didn't know everything that was going on. So they couldn't really make an informed opinion about what was going on. And so I ended up talking with him. He had actually come to me and brought up divorce. And I went back to him afterwards. And I was like, I've done a lot of thinking about the topic of divorce. And I think that we should get divorced. And he was just like, okay.
How did he react to that?
It was very weird. So I had made a whole dinner. I was having us sit down and talk. And I told him we had had a previous conversation that had me in tears and him talking crazy. Right, like talking about like let's get divorced, let's not tell anyone, and then we'll throw a party together and be like surprise, we're divorced. Like he was just so bizarre, and so I told him I was like, I thought a lot about it, and I think that you're right, going different directions. I think that we should get divorced. And I remember him just walking over to the refrigerator and grabbing a soda and being and opening it up and just being like, okay, and
Just
then
like
walk,
that.
sure. And so he just like walked away, and I was like. Okay. All right, this is happening. So I moved my what I needed into the spare bedroom. I was like, listen, I don't have a place lined up, but I'll just stay in the spare room for now and I'll work on finding an apartment and I'll move out. That was like right after Christmas. Our anniversary was January 3rd, I believe. And so I
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
It was literally only a couple days, and it was on our anniversary. He went out. He'd been drinking. I have no proof, but I feel like there were other substances involved. And at that moment, he just lost it and assaulted me worse than he had previously ever laid hands on me. When it was over, I waited for him to pass out, and I finally heard him snoring in the other room. And I grabbed what I could in the middle of the night, and I left, and I ended up homeless and living in my car. That was the last I ever saw him.
And he never contacted you after that. He never did anything. He never.
He never contacted me face to face. I had a barrage of text messages. He cleaned out all my bank accounts. I didn't need to live in my car as long as I did, but he had access to the accounts. And so he, as soon as my paycheck dropped, literally by the next morning when I was going in to access my money, he had spent all of it and then some. It wasn't until I could, okay, like get a new bank account set up, get my direct deposit stopped. So I had like a paper check to go open up a new account, and I got paid like every 2 weeks. So, he took my money. So I had to wait 2 full weeks before I could get access to my money again. That point, after a few weeks of that, I did finally reach back out to my parents and was like, all right, here's what's going on. Like, I know you told me to stay. I didn't. I'm living in my car. I found an apartment, but he's taken all my money. And so they were able to, from across the country, call down and pay the security deposit and first month's rent for me to get into an apartment.
At this period, who did you rely on for support?
So I have a cousin. She did not live near me. She lives, so if you're familiar with the East Coast of the United States, my parents were in Maine. She was in Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., and I was in Florida. So she was kind of like the halfway point. I would just be on the phone with her, talking to her through this whole thing. And she happens to be uniquely qualified to help with this stuff. She's a PhD in social work, and she's a master's of psychology. So she was like really good at helping me through the situation, getting me from point A to point B. So she was really my support system. Other people also came out from places I didn't expect. I was in grad school. I was working on my MBA in international business at the time. And the other people in my grad school program, when they found out that I was getting divorced and going through a really hard time, they helped me furnish my apartment. Like they would just be like, I have an extra microwave. I work, some of them worked at the corporate office of the local grocery chain, and they would just come there like, we get like these free gift cards. So here's like gift cards for groceries. And oh, I have a coffee table I was gonna get rid of. And because I left with nothing, I didn't have furniture or anything. So
What was the most challenging thing that you faced at this time?
honestly, it was the mental health aspect of it. Because as crazy as this might sound, I did not identify as a victim of domestic violence. I thought my husband was mean, and that was the language that I knew for it. It wasn't until I finally got into my apartment and things were like survival mode was starting to calm down a little bit, and I started having these dreams. And it was the same dream over and over again. I tell the whole story in my book, but the highlights is basically I would dream that my ex-husband would break into my apartment. And in the dream, he would sit next to me on my bed, and I would wake up and he'd be sitting there looking at me. And it was one of those like dreams in a dream, right? Where I thought I woke up, but I hadn't. And then I would wake up. And so I was having a really hard time sleeping. My mental health was really, really struggling. And I felt suicidal. And
Oh, I'm so
I
sorry about that.
Yes, thank you. I remember sitting on the floor just trying to figure out what I'm going to do, and ending my life was definitely one of the options I was thinking through. And I remember my work had an EAP program or employee assistance program. And so they had recently passed out flyers. I grabbed the flyer and there was a crisis line in there. And I was able to call the crisis line and talk with someone. And then before we got off the phone, they had scheduled me with an appointment the next day to talk to a mental health professional in the network for emergency situations. And when I went to talk to her and kind of like crying in her office and just being like, I don't know why my husband is so mean. And when she had me elaborate on what I meant, she was like, well, what you're describing is domestic violence. And that was kind of the light bulb moment for me where I was like, it is.
Yeah, I mean, lots of people don't recognize those things. Being controlling emotionally, financially, you spent all your money and didn't even think that you need even something to survive. So that's domestic violence. So lots of people don't recognize these little things as domestic violence. So this is why we raise awareness about these now, so that other people can listen. And if they're going through similar situations, they know what to do. They need to be able to speak to someone that is trusted, someone that is professional, and someone who knows what they're doing. So they need to be able to get the help they need to. I really appreciate you sharing all of that. I know it must be difficult actually referring back to that time. During that time, did you think of getting yourself out of the situation faster than you did?
That's a really hard question to answer.
Because you went the first time and then the second time and then you spent 4 years together. So yeah. The 4 years, was it smooth sailing? Well, why didn't you take this step out earlier?
Yeah, I mean, so the easiest way to answer that question is this phrase I heard one time: leaving is a process and it's not an event. And so, you know, the idea that you can just get up and leave somewhere is really a false narrative. It takes planning. It takes the right circumstances, especially when you are afraid of your spouse, you're afraid of your partner. 75% of women in the US who are murdered by their abuser, it happens while they're leaving or shortly after they've left. So leaving is literally the most dangerous time of a survivor's life. The abuser is, they're losing their control. The mask is coming off, right? Because they hide to the outside world, but now their partner's leaving them and everyone has questions. Well, why are they leaving? Why are you getting divorced? People are extremely nosy. And so they can't hide. One of the things that infuriates me beyond all things, so if people are listening, please don't ever say this. When someone talks about my partner abused me, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, whoever, and they say, I never saw that side of them, or they were always nice to me. Yeah, you're right. They were always nice to you because they actors, they're manipulators. They hide all of this stuff. And so I think that's really the best way to answer it is like, I just never really had the right moment to leave before. If you can read in my book, there was like kind of a series of events. He started having an affair. So his attention was no longer on me. So I felt like, okay, this is the time to do it. He had firearms in the house. It was just a dangerous place to live.
Oh, thank you. And right now, where are you at in your journey, in your life?
I'm still a work in progress. You know, I did have a PTSD diagnosis. I deal with triggers. Writing the book was super therapeutic. I highly recommend if people have triggers, they feel anxiety out of nowhere, they don't know really what it's coming from, just start writing stuff down. It can be really helpful to try to, you know, bring yourself back into your body. Writing the book helped me reintegrate a lot of disassociated memories, which allowed me to identify things that were setting me off, for lack of a better term. I feel like I found my purpose. The question, you know, would you go back and change anything? I mean, no. I feel like I survived something for a purpose, and that purpose has been to talk to people, to help other women, and for whatever.
How do you help other women? What are the things that you do with them?
So one of the big things is I'm on the board of an organization here in Maine called Together Invested, and we teach finances to women. We lead divorce workshops. We have a team of lawyers and social workers, arbitrators, like people who work with people going through divorce, CPAs, financial advisors, and we do monthly seminars. And then we do quarterly an event called Waking Up to Wealth, and I go as kind of like a keynote speaker and just talk about surviving financial and economic abuse, because that's a lot of women getting divorced, even though they may not be victims of true domestic violence.
Yeah.
a lot of men and women use money to control their partners. And so just talking about how to rebuild that relationship with money. My ex-husband stole my identity. He took out so much bad debt, never paid it, hid it from me. And it took me years to dig out from under it, but I was able to do it. And so I just kind of share some of those things that worked for me with other women.
And at those seminars that you say, the sessions that you organize with this community, are they free for women to attend and for people who are experiencing domestic violence? Are those free?
So we are a nonprofit. The classes and the divorce workshop, which is like an all-day thing, we include like food and everything. It's like $35 for the ticket, but we do have grants available for people if they're not able to pay the $35 that, you know, we can support someone who needs it, who is in a situation where they don't have the funds to pay the price for the ticket. So yeah.
And what's this organization? What are they called and what's their website and your book as well? You spoke about the book a few times now. So what's it called? Where can listeners find it?
So the organization is called Together Invested. If you just search for Together Invested online, you can pull that right up. And some of our sessions are virtual. So if you're not from the area, you can still get access to them. We also have them pre-recorded. So if you pay a fee, you can just get pre-recordings of all of the stuff. Attending live is great because there is a Q&A. And then my book is called Stronger Than That, Domestic Violence Survivor Uncovers the Truth About Her Abuser. The book is kind of one part memoir and one part true crime. My ex-husband did go on to commit the same financial crimes he committed against me, against a business partner. He was facing felony, grand larceny, and swindling charges for over $250,000. It was pretty significant. Things that he masterminded was like Ocean's 11, kind of weird. Like,
that sounds like it's huge.
Yeah, he was out on bond and he did die by suicide rather than go to prison for his crimes. So in the book, I interview everyone involved. I have all the police reports and coroner's reports and everything from both his criminal investigation and his death investigation. If you're interested in true crime, it's got some investigating in there. And then it also has my story about he and I, how we met, how it ended. And then I close the book out with a little afterword that's just words of advice for people. I also handled my own divorce. So there's tips in there if you need.
Brilliant.
How to get divorced.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for sharing your story. And what advice would you give anyone who is in a similar situation as you?
Again, it's a process, not an event. So if staying is safer right now, that's okay. But find yourself a network, find yourself some people. There are really great advocacy organizations out there. I know in the United States, we have a national hotline that you can call and they'll connect you with resources. Reach out, find that information. They will help you plan. They can help you strategize. They can help you find lawyers, social workers. If you have kids, they'll help you with custody, all that stuff. Most of these organizations also have places lined up for emergency housing. If you're in a very dangerous, immediate need, a lot of these organizations can help you with that. I wish I had known that when I went through a divorce. And then the other thing is just trust your gut, trust your instincts. Anger was an extremely healthy fuel for me during the time that I was going through this. It kept me moving forward and kept me from like falling back into that, like, oh, I'll forgive him and stay with him. But eventually you do have to forgive because that's like a cancer. You need to just get it out of your system eventually. But your body feels emotions for a reason. I think that they were put there to help us survive. So.
Oh, thank you. And what's the best part of your life right now?
Best part of my life right now is definitely my family. I remarried in 2020. Yes, we had a COVID wedding. My husband, Tom, he's been here through writing my book and he's super supportive of everything that I'm working on. And we have a beautiful daughter who is just the most fun person. The best parts of both of us, 100%. And yeah, we love our little family and our little bubble. And that's, you know, our dog and our cat. And
been awesome, really, hearing everything. I mean, the good, the bad, the good, and then the ugly. So everything is there. You are now in a good place. So it's so amazing.
Exactly. If I can do it, anybody can. You just keep pushing forward. Just move. That's all you got to do.
Thank you. So this podcast will be shared on all podcast platforms. We're on Google, Apple, Spotify, Podbean, anywhere you listen to your podcast. So please subscribe and share with your friends and family. It's always good to listen to different people's stories because it's not, and we don't always talk about abusive relationships. We talk about disabilities, cancer, ADHD, autism, and different things. But today's one has been about Sarah's story of living in financial abuse, and so many women and men actually in the same situation. So she's been helpful, she's been forthcoming with all the advice, and hopefully that will do something for someone. Thank you so much and all the best in the future.
A big thank you to all our listeners who have been sending us messages through the message link. I would like to thank everyone who has listened in so far and contributed to this podcast. Thank you so much. We couldn't have done anything without you. Keep listening, keep sharing, keep downloading, and keep liking. Thank you again.